Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Tulsa World Opinion Video Podcast this week. I am really excited about my guest. I'm here with former Osage Nation Chief Jim Gray. He was also the publisher of the Native American Times until he became chief in 2002. He's a consultant right now, and what I'm really excited about is he's going to be a member of the Tulsa World Community Advisory Board. So, yay. I'm excited to have you on here because your op-ed that you've written this week is one that I think everyone should read. And I think it's poses some interesting thought-provoking questions. And I just wanted to highlight it and go into a deep dive. So welcome.
Thank you for having me on. I'm glad to be here.
So anyone who has sought additional information on the book or the movie, Killers of the Flower Moon, particularly to know what the Osage feel about it, they're going to come up against your comments. I mean, you have been outspoken, you've been involved. And I think in the 8 years you were chief, how does the media coverage you went through then compare to the media coverage you've gone through in the last year? I mean,
I have never been in the media as much in the last few months as I ever was in those 8 years as chief. We would get in the news every now and then, but nothing like this. The intensity from both local and national and international media has been really overwhelming. And I live here in Skytook, and I have my lawyer's been kind enough to open up his office for me. And so I've had people come in and, the Daily Mail, BBC, the Associated Press of France, other groups, large and small, podcasts, both local and regional and national, have all flown in to meet with me in Skytook to conduct interviews. Bloomberg, I mean, everybody. It's been really interesting because I would go into my lawyer's office and the administrative assistants that work there would always look up at me and say, "Well, who are we meeting with today?" And I said, "Well, today we're meeting with the French." And it was like,
"Well," and so I really appreciate you taking time out for the Tulsa World. So thank
yes,
you.
Well, this is longtime reader, loyal subscriber, the whole thing. So yeah.
Well, for people who aren't aware, because there may be some people out there, your personal connection to this history is that your great grandfather is Henry Roan, and he was a victim of the Reign of Terror. And right. A central important part of the case, because his case was the one that convicted William Hale, the ringleader. And this story has been told in various ways in the last 100 years. But when you, and this is a question I know that a lot of this media have asked you, which is when you found out David Grand, the New York Times reporter, was doing a book on this. And then when the movie rights were sold.
Mm-hmm.
What were your concerns at this point? Because this is your personal family history. What went through your mind as how you wanted that handled?
Well, a lot of what the David Grand wrote was based on the research that he did from the FBI files. So this is familiar territory because this isn't the first book that's been written about that period of time. This is like the fourth or fifth book that I've read. And they all cover it in a similar manner. And that's probably, just the straight up aspects of it that they were able to actually prosecute this crime, even though there were all these other crimes that were committed that the FBI, for a variety of different reasons, never pursued. But because they pursued this one, it did elevate my great-grandfather's name in the public consciousness of these series of crimes. And so I knew all that before the book came out. I knew, that a lot of Osage families had similar stories in their family, but they weren't investigated. And the crimes never saw the light of day, and their families still never got justice. And so I've always been very cognizant of that, especially after being chief, to be very deferential to Osage's points of view on this, even though I have very, thoughts of my own. And one of which is that while other people are free to remain quiet about it and not talk about these times, for lots of personal reasons that each family has, I did not have the luxury of being quiet about it simply because it was already out there. You know, the story of his life and his murder as detailed in the book really didn't give me the luxury of being anonymous about the whole story. And so rather than just ignore it or be ambivalent about it, I chose to be engaged and try to put some humanity in his story as best I could with whatever opportunities I had to talk about it. So when the movie was announced, I was deeply concerned because there is a lot of violence in this story, and I was worried that the violence was going to take central stage to other aspects of the story about the people who were murdered and the exploitation that was taking place, and I didn't want that to get lost, and that was my biggest concern, that some attention should be paid to the victims and why their story needs to be told.
One of the amazing things when I think about you and your role that you've played here is how you handle seeing the scene, that no matter how it was handled, you personally, even if you didn't know your great-grandfather, putting myself in your position, mm-hmm. I don't know how I could handle seeing an ancestor murdered on screen, particularly with this high-profile movie. And I'm just curious how you prepare yourself for something like that, because it's so personal.
I don't know if what I did was the right way to handle it, but I had my whole life to think about it because I'm named after him. My middle name is Roan. My mother, who didn't talk much about that reign of terror, she was born in the 20s, but she grew up basically having that whole side of her family die during that decade. So if she didn't want to talk about it, I didn't pressure her at all, but it kind of made me think that she was trying to accomplish a couple of things. One was that there was no need to talk about it to her young son, but as he got older, she took time to tell me different things about it. But a lot of it was just generalities and nothing really specific. But for me, it forced me to do my own research as I grew up and became my own man. And I started doing my own research, and I started finding out that it wasn't just him who got murdered. It was a whole series of murders, some of which were investigated and prosecuted, but most were not. That much I knew, you know. So, but back to his death and the way he died, he was shot from the back of the head. So it was difficult to try to imagine how this was going to be played out on the screen. When you have a director like Martin Scorsese, who's well known throughout his 50 years in film, that he does capture violence in his films. It's a big feature in all of his films. And so I worried that there would be, maybe a little too gory or glorified aspects of it. So my concerns were at the worst end of the spectrum, you know. And when I finally sat and watched the movie, I knew it was going to be in the movie, because there's no way you can tell the story without showing his murder and the trial of the people who ordered his killing and those who did it. So I knew that it was going to be in there, and it was, but it wasn't glorified. It wasn't, they didn't spend a lot of time on it. And as soon as they showed his murder, they moved on to the next scene. And of course they came back to it during the trial, but I'm not, when I think about all the different ways it could have been done, this one probably seems the least worst from just the gory, violent glorification aspect of what my fears were. This was more subdued and direct, and but he was still murdered, and it still showed it, and there's no getting around it. And so I had 6 years to think about it, you know, when the book came out, and I knew this was coming. So by the time it did happen, I was prepared as much as I could be, as much as anybody could be, I guess, for what was going to be on the screen.
How many times have you seen the movie now?
I got a preview in early May as a descendant of one of the victims that were murdered in this film. And they had an Osage opening in July, and I got to see it then. And I got to see it in the in LA when they had the premiere there in October. And then once the movie came out on opening day here in Oklahoma, I finally was able to get my whole family together, and we all watched it together, my wife and my kids and their siblings and their companions. And so we occupied a whole row at Circle Cinema and got to see it there. Mm-hmm. And so I've seen it 4 times.
Wow. So one of the things that I saw go viral on social media was after you watched it in the special screening as a descendant, mm-hmm. you posted your first impressions. And right. You were very complimentary, talking about how Scorsese met with the Osage people basically throughout this first script. Yeah. You know, that story's been told a lot about how everyone seemed to, they hired cultural advisors, and you were complimentary. And I wanted to read this part that you said in that post that went viral. You say the dignity and the care for the Osage perspective was genuine and honest throughout the process. And the Osage responded with the kind of passion and enthusiasm that met this historic moment. And, you know, I wondered, because that was your first impression, do you still feel the same, or has your perspective shifted at all about how the movie was handled?
Well, I'll tell you this. Every time I've seen it, and like I said, I've seen it 4 times, I pick up something new that I didn't see the first time. And it makes me even appreciate the attention to detail even more that Mr. Scorsese incorporated so many different key elements of Osage culture and lifeways into this film that it was not in the FBI files and it was not in the book. It was only obtained by listening to Osages. So yeah, I still feel the same way about it. And it had to be a two-way street, Jenny. There was no way that Scorsese would have been able to gather that kind of information had he not earned the trust of the Osage people to share with them some of the more unique details of our cultural life, ceremonials and language and customs and interactions that the general audience probably wouldn't notice, but to any Osage sitting in the audience who grew up and was raised Osage would pick up almost immediately that, oh wow, they did the funeral service this way, or oh my goodness, this is exactly what a wedding coat looks like. And some of the conversations between the Osages, what they found funny and interesting was also captured, and just simple little things. I mean, but when you add them all up, there's like 25 different things that just were incorporated that were not in any other source material other than just talking to Osages. Huh. And so when I wrote that, my first impression, my lasting impression after watching it for the first time, I had signed a non-disclosure agreement with Apple to not talk about it. So for like 2 weeks leading up to the opening at Cannes Film Festival in late May, I had 2 weeks to sit there and stew about it in my own mind about all the different things I saw that I couldn't talk about. And so when I got that email from their lawyers that morning telling me that I've been partially lifted from my non-disclosure agreement to talk simply about the film, not about any other private conversations I had with Mr. Scorsese before, during, or after that screening, which I still hold to today. But I will say this, that what I saw on the screen was just my emotional impressions. And there's been so much attention devoted to different aspects of the film the violence, the issues of the amount of screen time Leonardo got compared to Lily. And I'll let the people debate that however long they want to. I just, as an Osage and as someone who has some really personal direct ties to this story, was genuinely worried going in that there was not going to be enough agency for the Osages to feel like this was their story, or this was going to be an FBI story, or it's just going to be a story from the killer's point of view and the celebration of the oil and gas culture that existed up there in the 1920s and the exploitation of the people who just happened to be in the way kind of thing. I mean, there was a lot of different directions this film could have gone, and it didn't go there. It kept the Osages involved, even though, you know, Molly's screen time was far less than what Leo's was. Anytime she was in a scene, she dominated the scene, and she captured the Osage perspective in every scene she was in. So it did move the story closer to the heart of the Osage. It wasn't the heart of the story, but the Osage story aspect of it was closer to the heart of the story than it was initially designed. And so I devoted that whole series of tweets I made to just talking about the process and the collaboration that took place, not knowing whether it was going to be captured on the screen. And I was happy to report that it was. And I still feel that way.
Yeah, those details were fabulous. I want to go back and watch it again just to see like the home.
You have to see it more than once. Yeah, I mean, take that example.
Yeah.
There is a scene that when the first screenshot from the film was the scene of Molly and Ernest at the dinner table. Mm-hmm. To an Osage looking at that scene, it was, okay, there's faux china on the table. Mm-hmm. There's no knife and fork. There's only a spoon. And what looks like grape dumplings is in the bowl. And so for the way, Molly carried herself just in that picture, you could tell it was like an Osage, how an Osage woman would have dressed at that time and how she would have worn the blanket and all this stuff, you know. And it was just, it did make you feel a lot more confident that what was coming was going to have a lot of Osage culture in it. And that scene that picture is taken from in the movie is a scene where she's telling him to settle down. There's a storm coming, you know, and the reverence for the power of the elements and the storm is something that we Osages acknowledge. And to see her assert her cultural understanding in her own home before this person, with this person who's not Osage, shows a level of confidence and cultural awareness of her own ways, and then maybe a small attempt to try to help him understand her ways was really captured in that scene. And, you know, for an Osage, that's very encouraging that our ways did not take a back seat. Mm-hmm. To anything else that was in the scene and in the movie.
Are there some other scenes that you remember or you think that's really important that had to have been in there to really understand where the Osage are coming from on this, where you're coming
from?
Yeah,
there's this one moment where Molly whispers into her sister's ear, she says, "You are my wealth." Mm. And I think in a way that goes back to pre-oil, pre-removal kind of Osage mentality, that your blessings as a human being and your strength as a person is derived from your family and your community. And when she whispers in her ears, "You are my wealth," she's not talking about money. She's not talking about inheritance. She's talking about that connection of having a family. We have this word in the Osage language, it's called wachbai. And wachbai means pitiful. And when they use that word, when the Osages use that word to describe somebody's situation, it's usually in derived to the fact that he doesn't have or she doesn't have a family anymore, through loss or death or whatever. Somebody's going through a lonely moment in their life where they don't have an immediate family they can call upon to help them. And Wahabi is like, that's the worst you could be. It's the worst situation you could be. And so I saw that scene and it just conjured up all these energies of my emotions about what that kinship relationship that your family possesses, that's part of who you are as a family. So when Molly says that, and then you fast forward to that scene at the bottom of the stairs when she learns that her last surviving sister has been murdered in the most brutal way, that scream she lets out is as genuine and as real and as grounded in the Osage way as you could possibly imagine. And even though the film doesn't draw those connections as directly as I would have liked, it's there. It's in there. Anybody who sees this movie or reads this book and decides on their own that I want to learn more, that, you know, you'll find things like that in the film that are truly Osage, that just make you feel so much more comfortable that the care and attention that was given by the filmmakers to capture that and the willingness of the Osages to share some of these more intimate details of our cultural way of life that didn't get wasted, didn't find themselves on the editing room floor. They actually made it into the film. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I go all the way back to that first set of tweets, and I still feel that way. I didn't spend a lot of time on the tweets to talk about the film itself, except that the collaboration and the process, I knew a lot of people weren't going to know about. And that was something I did know about because I witnessed a lot of it as an Osage who lives here, saw the relationship evolve, and it became this partnership, if you will, of getting this story as true and accurate and incorporating as much culture of the Osage people into it, so that when, unfortunately, these folks did die, you had a basis of understanding their humanity. And I think that was important. Otherwise, what was the point?
Right.
You know,
and it's interesting that you make that point of wanting to know more. I saw it with my son, my 19-year-old son, and he, because they didn't spend a lot of time explaining the concept of guardianship.
Right.
But you saw what the result was. Mm-hmm. You know, it's Molly asking a banker for her own money. It was your great-grandfather being so, you know, enraged, rightly, that he couldn't even have his own money. Yeah. And so that, and my son hadn't heard of that. I mean, we talk about the history we don't know. And so afterwards, we had this whole conversation about, well what was that? How did that happen? Yeah. Why was that allowed to happen? Well, of course this man's going to be upset. So
is that we have a documentary that dives a little deeper into the certain elements of mm-hmm. not just what happened, but, you know, how it happened, you know,
right.
And what changes in law were made in order to ensure that despite the wealth the Osages had rightfully earned by owning that land and having this their share of the royalties paid to them, that they still insisted that a white person be put in charge of how they spent their money. And in when you look at the practices of some of these guardians, it was a license to steal, and it was the equivalent of putting the fox in charge of the hen house, and the exploitation just kept on going. And there was one scene where they showed that it was payment day and there was this scramble out on the street of somebody yelling about you can't collect your money unless your guardian's with you kind of thing. And yeah, there wasn't enough attention. I agree with your son. There wasn't enough attention paid to that aspect of the story, but because it did drive a lot of some of the decisions Osages were making, you know, and because they had to go before this individual. Mm-hmm. And they would make judgments on whether or not you were entitled to that money.
Right. For everybody. And, but at the same time, I understand where as a filmmaker, you know, just like as a writer, I can't fit everything into one story,
Right.
everything. It's already a 3.5 hour. So, but
what do you take out to include that? I don't know.
Exactly. And so, but it started that conversation. It made him want to know more about what happened. And maybe that's one of the takeaways, is that it puts it on the screen in a way that makes people want to know more. But you said something earlier about that your reactions were about, you wanted to explain the Osage involvement in the film, that you knew that because you were part of that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big part of the aftermath of this film, was who can tell the story, because a lot of people are questioning,
right?
Are Osage happy with this? Should David Cran have written the book as a white guy? Should Martin Scorsese have been the one to tell the story? And without giving away the endings, I do think it was I like the ending. I thought it was
a good
way of, because he basically is giving the nod of, yes, white people have been the drivers of this particular narrative.
Yeah.
And it's a big question about who should be able to tell stories of history, and really who should profit from it. So I don't know the answer, but I am curious of your thoughts about that. Who should tell the stories?
Well, in the perfect world, it would be us, right? It's our story. It's our history. It happened to our families.
Right.
We should be able to talk about it. And I think in some ways, this movie will give us a window of opportunity to fill that space with our own interpretation of it. At the time the book came out, I actually wrote an op-ed in Indian Country Today asking these very questions out loud to the reader. And it wasn't that I was anti-David Graham or, you know, at the time, because I was really pro-Osage. And I was speaking to it from that point of view, knowing as a former chief and as a descendant of one of the victims in this story, there's a tendency to fear, a legitimate fear, that we're going to get exploited all over again, you know, and not just in the way the book captures that dark chapter in our history, but in the retelling of the way we were exploited by exploiting us yet again, you know.
Right.
So these were questions that I was raising in 2017. And ultimately, you know, that's not how the world works in our society. Hollywood tells these stories with whoever the best storyteller they can hire to tell them, you know. And I think we're moving closer to a day when the Sterling Harjos of the world will be given the reins to capture a large, you know, multi-million dollar film project of historical importance. We haven't hit that day yet, but I think we're a heck of a lot closer to it after this movie than we were before it was made. And so I think of it as a process, just like my evolution as an Osage, fearing the worst and hoping the best in 2017, and watching those two perspectives get closer and closer together over time. And there was no reason for me to believe in 2017 that there would be this outreach of incorporation, of collaboration that existed between the descendants of those who were murdered and the Osage tribe itself, and what the filmmakers were willing to incorporate into the film. You couldn't have predicted that in 2017, that collaboration was going to evolve to the extent that it did. And so, so even though I had reason to believe, because Hollywood doesn't have a good track record of giving the Osages their space, or any indigenous people their space to tell their story, that it's not as 100% as I would like, but it's a huge step in the right direction, in my opinion.
I wanted to give a shout out, and I haven't read the book yet, but you had suggested this book on a podcast that you guest hosted, which was A Pipe for February.
That's right. Yeah.
Written by Charles Redcorn.
who's an Osage elder and a man of letters. He's got an advanced degree from Penn. He's spent his entire life immersed in the Osage culture. He worked in Indian country throughout his life, and is a terrific writer. And over the course of his life, he sat down and interviewed numerous Osages whose stories of exploitation and murder and theft had taken place, but none of those investigations, none of those crimes were ever investigated. So this book doesn't rely on the FBI. In fact, it completely ignores it, because 90% of all the crimes committed against Osages were ignored by the FBI. And so, and the state and local governments that had responsibility to prosecute crimes in our community. And so this story was how the Osages relied upon their own resources and their own religious and faith and cultural ways to survive that period of time when you didn't know who your friends were, you didn't know who you can trust. And all the people that were set up to look out for you were the ones actually trying to get at you. And this was often, you know, I think it's often forgotten in the story, but you got to remember the federal policies of the day towards Indians and Indian tribes were assimilation and breaking up of the tribal governments and destroying the language and destroying the culture of the tribes and to force them into assimilation of some form of utopia, you know, where they would just abandon everything that they knew to be true in their whole lives and their ancestors' lives had to be abandoned. And, you know, Scorsese read the book and he came back, as you know, to shoot additional scenes. One of the scenes that he shot was this one that's not in Killers of Flower Moon, but it's in A Pipe for February. It's the opening scene of the film, of the ceremonial bearing of that pipe. That is from A Pipe for February. And I'm so glad he was moved to adopt that aspect into the story, because it doesn't talk about, you know, the discovery of oil as much as it talks about the Osage's way of life is going to have to evolve in order for it to survive as a people. There were things that just would not serve our people, because it's just a matter of demographics. From our first treaty in 1808 to the last treaty in 1868 and our removal from Kansas to Indian Territory in 1872, what you saw during that 60, 70-year period of time, Jenny, was a 90% of our population had passed away.
Wow.
We were 20,000 strong at the time we signed our first treaty with the United States. And 70 years later, there was a little over 1,000 of us that came down here from Kansas. And so that moment when the elders who we lost so much ability to understand what those implements of our culture meant, that some of it could not be passed down. And so a lot of people buried those elements of our society that served us for centuries, because our younger generation would not be able to comprehend, because it wasn't effectively passed down to the elders of that time, because those elders passed away. And so the loss of 90% of your population resulted in a complete acceptance that we're going to have to adapt to survive as a people.
That meant
putting certain things away and allowing our youth to incorporate new things of the Western world and things of that nature. And so it's a powerful, powerful moment to begin this movie with, that I can honestly say set the tone for the amount of Osage that's going to be seen in this film, because the only reason you would put that in there is that if you were listening to Osages and Osage voices about that period of time, because that burying of the pipe takes place about 20, 25 years before the events of the Killers of the Flower Moon take place.
Okay.
So it's kind of a prequel kind of moment. And even though it doesn't say that, it definitely shows it in the film.
I have seen or read different estimates of how many citizens were killed during the Reign of Terror, that up to 10%, and I think it was up to 10% of the tribe may have been killed. What are sort of the, what do the Osage believe, how many people were lost in that?
I've heard a lot of different numbers and estimates from people over my entire life. And if there is an average, it's probably around 100. There's people who predict less. There's some, most predict more. Part of the problem, and the only way you could kind of get at that number, is just look at the mortality rates. If you read the book, The Deaths of Sybil Bolton, written by Washington
Post. It's been a while, but I did read it when it came out.
Dennis McAuliffe, he covers part of that question. And what he points out to is just the normal mortality rate of Osage County from 1907 to 1927 was about 10% a year. But if you were in Osage with a head right, your mortality rate was closer to 70%. Now, did they die by normal causes? Probably some of them did. Did they die by a car wreck, accident, alcohol poisoning, wasting disease?
Exactly. The made up diseases.
They hung themselves. They drove their car off a cliff. Yeah, all of those scenarios were part of the record of how certain Osages died. But it's really odd that such a disproportionate number of them died happened to be Osages with head rights.
I don't think anyone buys that that's a coincidence. So
Right.
You know, one of the things that I was, when we spoke about the op-ed before, I was, you know, kind of curious to begin with, what were your impressions or concerns before to now? But one of the things you wrote in the, because I want to give it away, people are going to read this op-ed. That's okay. Why we're doing this. But you take the question that's asked to you most through these, you know, this high profile thing, you sort of turn it on its head and in a thought provoking way that I appreciate. But the question that you get a lot from what your op-ed says is, what are the lessons or the legacy of this history?
Yeah.
And you're asked that a lot. And you sort of take it in this op-ed and you're asking, turn around, and you're asking the community, you're asking us. You know, you have been upfront about how this affected your family, your tribe, but now it's time to ask the community, the world. Yeah. What are the lessons you take away? What are we going to learn from that after reading the book, after watching the movie? And it makes you think. It makes, the first thing I thought of, I'll admit, was, is very specific. It's House Bill 1775 in Oklahoma, yeah, right, which restricts the teaching of certain race and gender issues. And it bothered me when, and I was against it when it passed because of this, because we know we are not learning the full and accurate history of anything, whether it's the Tulsa Race Massacre or the Osage Reign of Terror, that now we're making it even harder to learn the full and accurate history. And for me, you know, I'm like, how do we get past that? And it's very frustrating. And you live in Oklahoma, so you know what I'm talking about. And it also has to do with, and you mentioned this earlier, which is the laws that we have. And I'm always thinking about, you know, we think about these history as being history, like that happened, we solved it, we're not going to do that again. But guardianship was legal. The Trail of Tears was a legal act, the subjugation of women, a legal act. And so I do think now, what are we doing that's legal? Because people want to go back and say, well, that's the law. But what are the laws now that are harming other people?
Yeah, I'm trying to, and when it comes to this House Bill 1775, I've been fairly outspoken about my opposition to it for obvious reasons as well. But in one interview that I was asked about in Oklahoma City, local TV station, was that they were asking me, why do you think they won't teach this? And I said, because they didn't before this law was passed. So all this law does is make sure that it will never come up. You know, that's all it seems to have accomplished. So my question to you is that simply because it wasn't taught before, then why was this law passed? What problem is this law seeking to solve? Because if this 1775 was designed to address a problem in our school system, somebody please tell me what the problem was. Because I don't see anything in the high school curriculum in my entire life. And I've lived in Oklahoma for over 50 years. And there was never a mention of the Osage Reign of Terror in my school books. And the Tulsa Race Massacre, nothing there, you know. So I'm wanting to know, and I put the question to that reporter. I was like, when is somebody going to ask this guy who's promoting this law and enforcing this law, what is it that he's trying to stop by enforcing this law? What is it? What is the ogre in the room that is occurring in Oklahoma? It's not the teaching of the Osage Reign of Terror. It's not the Tulsa Race Massacre, because those things were never in our curriculum. So what is it that they're passing? What is it that they're solving by passing this law?
Right. It's what are they afraid of? And Killers of the Flower Moon was pulled. There have been teachers pulling that.
Yeah, that was out of fear. It was just out of a general fear, because while it doesn't tell you specifically in the law where that line is, a teacher, if they cross, they're going to get in trouble, right? It's really vague in how it's written. It's like, we don't know where the violation occurs only until after we decide you do, you know? So if that's the environment teachers are having to work in and trying to teach uncomfortable aspects of Oklahoma history or our nation's history, chances are they're not going to put their teacher certificate on the line to even find out. And I think that's where we're at now. The goal of this law was to make sure that they don't teach it, even though the political winds of the day seem to want to encourage that because of the book and the film and the anniversary of these horrific events of occurring right now as we talk, that there might be a desire for some people to want to try to introduce this into the high school system. But this law has just come in and says, you're not even going to try it, you know, because we're not going to tell you where to cross the line, but we'll definitely take your license away if you do, you know.
And it's so harmful in the way that to understand the issues that tribes are up against now with McGirt, mm-hmm. To understand the concept of sovereignty, what that means to we can't do that unless we understand what happened just 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. And 100 years is not long.
No,
that, you know, not really. These atrocities have a generational effect, as you've spoken well too. But, you know, I wanted to, this does kind of bring up something that I was curious about, because you were chief, gosh, it was 20 years ago, I think, when you were elected, it didn't seem that long ago. But what were kind of the issues of the moment when you were chief, that from 2002 to 2010, was that when you were chief?
Yeah.
So what would you say would be your accomplishments or the challenges that you were facing then?
Well, there's two ways to answer that. Some of it were internal challenges that, mm-hmm. that we overcame. We had a system of our government that basically created an apartheid system at Osage that goes all the way back to that 1906 Allotment Act. And everyone knows about the mineral estate, and that's the aspect of the law that everyone understands. But what was never given enough attention was the fact that once they issued out those 2,229 original head rights to every man, woman, and child in the tribe, they closed the rolls. At the time, that wasn't a problem. Fast forward 96 years later, we only got 9 original allottees still alive. And the question was being raised, what happens when the Osage last allottee dies? because in the strict reading of the 1906 Act, the only Osages the United States recognizes are the ones that are on those original allotment rolls. And we never amended that law to allow us to redefine who an Osage is. And so we had to get federal law passed in order for us to be able to reorganize our tribe, define who an Osage is, and reform our entire tribal government to meet those specific areas that have been just neglected just because the politics of our tribe were defined around oil and gas matters and not necessarily about culture, language preservation, non-energy related economic development, like gaming and things of that nature, and strengthening our sovereignty as a tribal government to improve the lives of our citizens, educate our children, address the healthcare disparities that existed in our tribe. We were never really fully functional as a tribe to be able to do that, knowing that only 25-30% of our tribe called all the shots for the other 170-80% that were just completely left out of the political decisions of the tribe. And so that was the big thing I did. It was getting that constitutional reform, opening up 7 casinos, having the millions of dollars that came from those casinos poured into education, healthcare, economic development, minerals and natural resources, governance and justice, and environmental the policies. And
that's no small thing you pulled
no,
off.
No, it was, I crammed an awful lot of stuff in 8 years. So
that's a lot.
And I'm really proud of the fact that we created these departments within the tribe, especially the culture and language departments, because who knew that 12 years later, Martin Scorsese was going to come in with the $200 million investment from Apple, and they want to incorporate Osage language and culture in the film. And we find, you know, had that happened 30 years ago, I'm not sure we would have been able to help them to the extent that we did in this making of this film, had we not made those critical, huge investments in language and cultural preservation. And so I'm really proud of the fact that the Osages and the chief deployed those resources that the tribe had in a collaborative effort to give them everything that we could to help tell this story as much as with as much Osage perspective as possible. And our historic preservation office that was also included. And you know, there was different elements of our tribe's resources that were deployed, our museum, archives department, all kinds of departments within the tribe that didn't exist prior to that reform, that were available to the filmmakers at the time they were putting this film together. So that's my big achievement. Other things that happened were we initiated an initiative to get Class 3 gaming passed here in Oklahoma. And that happened in 2005. And I was part of an effort with other tribes in the state that poured real money into communicating to every voter in Oklahoma, a statewide effort to encourage them to vote yes for gaming, because the money was going to be prioritized towards public education and things of that nature. And I was really glad to have been part of that. Our tribe did a lot of direct mail pieces here in our area where we had influence, and I'm happy to report that when the vote came through, the percentage of people voting yes was higher than the statewide average. So wow. I was very happy about that.
Well, as a person who grew up in small town and in rural Oklahoma, and as a non-Indigenous person, I've always said that as far as infrastructure for rural areas, mm-hmm. the tribes have always been amazing partners. I mean, honestly, if there's a county road that needs to be
right
raised or paved, you're much more likely to have the tribe who's there to do that than the state government. I mean, it's always been, you know, a very good relationship that I saw until recently. And I think it's fair to say that the state tribal relationships are sort of non-existent
yeah.
right now. And that kind of brings me to the next question, which is, we focused a lot with the movie and the book on the past and talking about the past. And, but much of what we're, you know, I deal in my life, and I know your life, is what are we dealing with now? Mm-hmm. What, and maybe that, that past affects what we're dealing with now, that understanding. But when you look at where, what issues and challenges lie ahead for tribal nations that are located in Oklahoma, what are you thinking of? What are the things that you think, like right now there's a meeting in New Orleans, we were talking about earlier before mm-hmm. the podcast, of tribal leaders. What are they talking about? What's on the priority list?
Well, here's a couple of ideas that I mm-hmm. think that are on people's minds. A lot of what we saw in the movie was around oil and gas exploration. Osages are not the only tribe who had to deal with this kind of development on their land. There's three affiliated tribe in North Dakota that's dealing with the Bakken Formation that's on their reservation, sits on the Southern Ute in Colorado, Jicarilla in New Mexico, Navajo in the Four Corners area, uranium mining, and there's been a lot of natural resource extraction. What I think we are 100 years later in the 2020s is hopefully a reversal of priorities of having development take place on our land, but maybe not necessarily non-renewable energy development, things like solar, geothermal, other renewable sources of generating electricity and energy for this country's economy could be found on tribal reservations around the country. And this administration has passed the Inflation Reduction Act, which includes an enormous amount of incentives for private industry to invest in tribal nations to a degree that we've never seen before. We're talking billions and billions of dollars are being sent to encourage industry to partner with tribes to create renewable energy infrastructures and some non-renewable energy infrastructure as well. I don't want to leave that out. But we're in a period of time, both in Indian country and the nation as a whole, of developing everything is on the table energy plan, you know. And we know that the research and development, that investment that have been made in renewable energy sources like wind and solar have revolutionized the industries to the point where it's now a viable addition to our energy portfolio as a country. And a lot of these investments have taken place outside of Indian country, and we see the benefits of those things. Only now do we see tribes being invited to be part of that process. That's the biggest thing that I see from my point of view right now, is that are we going to capture this moment? Are we going to take advantage of the window of opportunity that we have with the money, resources, and policies all aligned with industry to take full advantage of the situation as a way to help support the energy needs of this country while providing jobs, by providing a revenue stream, by providing low energy costs, and the obvious positive impacts renewable energy has on the environment. Right. And so there's a lot of good things happening in that sector. Apart from that, I think we need to strengthen our sovereignty in ways that have maybe been neglected over the years, simply because in my adult life, I've seen an enormous investment in the tribal economies, from gaming, tax power, various other energy development projects and things of that nature. And I think what is going to probably be the challenge for the future are the rights of the tribal individual citizen who is enrolled in these tribes to have a stronger voice in how these tribal governments are involved. Right now, from our standpoint at Osage, we see all these great things happening. There's truly a renaissance of Osage art and culture and economy taking place at our tribe right now. And And I don't want to take anything away from that, because there's a lot of things that's going on in our tribe to be proud of. But where I see a disturbing trend, and I hope it gets addressed sometime in the future, is the largest segment of the demographics of our tribe are people 30 and under. And yet they are the least represented when it comes to voting in our tribal elections. Now, I know this isn't an isolated case just for Osages, because I see those same trends nationally and statewide.
Right.
And I think there's something that we need to do. We need to invest in civics. The way our politicians talk to one another is just, it's embarrassing for democracy. And
Yes.
the last thing you want is for tribal governments to adopt the worst elements of our democracy and incorporate them in their tribal government. And I know we can do better, and I know we can set an example. And I think there's some old traditional Osage ways that are incorporated in our new constitution that we operate that reward and encourage good behavior. And we have an ethics law, and we do follow it. And to the extent that it becomes something top of mind and not something that we ignore, is only dependent on the Osage people expecting our leaders to behave that way. And because what good is a constitution if no one believes in it? And because we've been deprived of having a governing document for 100 years, maybe it's easier for me to appreciate it, just like it's easier for a newly a new citizen of this country to feel a certain pride of being in America, because they came from a different country and they went through in the process and got their American citizenship, or in kind of like maybe somebody who's just been deprived of something for a long time and finally getting a chance to exercise the benefits of a democracy, that maybe they can see it a little bit more clearly than maybe somebody who's just gotten used to it and too comfortable with it and maybe complacent about what it takes to protect it. And I think that's true, not just in our country nationally, but I think it's true in tribal governments too. I mean, we have tribes that have hundreds of thousands of members, and their chief elections are decided by 5 or 10,000 people.
That's yeah, and that kind of
And,
tracks with a lot of elections. Yeah,
and we have.
I'm thinking that if you can inspire Osage people to young Osage citizens to vote in your elections, and the likelihood is they're going to vote in the Oklahoma and U.S.
Exactly.
elections. That
Right.
once you get someone motivated to do that, and gosh, I love the concept rewarding good behavior. Since we just had a senator, try to fight someone on this Senate floor. I mean, it's a world that makes me just shake my head. And the idea that we can have governments that behave better. I love that there's a way to inspire that.
Well, you
That's
you
amazing.
want, I heard it said somewhat cynically, sometimes we get the government we deserve. And dadgummit, I think we deserve better. I really
Yes,
do. I
we
think we
do.
deserve better, and I think we should insist on it as citizens in this country
Yes.
and do our part in every election cycle to participate. And I say that knowing that I skipped a local tax election yesterday. So I got a lot of work to do myself in that department.
Well, I try to, there was one like special school board election I missed years ago, and I'm still. I want to have that. It's like perfect attendance. I want to have that perfect voting record. So I'm working on that myself, but we'll get there. But we could probably talk for another hour, but we have to wrap it up at some point. But I thank you so much for coming on here, and I know that the Tulsa World readers are going to really appreciate your contributions in op-eds in the future as community board member. And what people don't know about you is that you're married to Libby Gray, who is,
That's
I
right.
want to get her on here because she's a force. She's
In most circles in Indian country, I'm not Chief Gray. I'm Libby's husband. And
exactly.
that's a
Well, it
new
was a
title
toss-up.
that I am very proud of. I am very proud of that.
She's been one of the nation's leading advocates in the missing and murdered Indigenous people
That's
effort,
right.
and that's, I think, one of the most important, critical, and serious things that anyone can do. And the fun thing, she's a designer now. So mm-hmm. she's got Lily Gladstone wearing outfits.
Her heart and head are in accord right now with her work.
Exactly. And I go, that's quite a balance there that she's, yeah. I will have her on.
And I'll be more proud of her. And exactly. Yes, she could go into great detail about the effects of McGirt on domestic violence issues and MMIW issues all day long.
Yeah.
And it would be very interesting for your readers to follow her.
Well, I'm going to, when she has time to, which I don't know if she ever has time, but I'll seek her as well. But I always wrap up wanting to give the guests the last word. And so what are some parting, we've spoken a lot about a lot of things, but what are some parting thoughts you want to leave with?
Well, the only parting thought, because we're Native American Heritage Month, mm-hmm. I do this every year around this time of year, and I'm glad you've given me a chance to say it here on a larger platform. But, you know, with Black Friday coming up next week, there's going to be an awful lot of retail activity at the stores and everywhere. And I just want you to know that if, to the extent that your readers who may desire to do that annual trip to the mall or to your computer to order online or whatever it is you do for Christmas, think about ordering Native American products that are designed and created by Indian artists, Native American artists. Support the books that are written by Native American authors. Watch movies produced by Native American producers, Res Dogs, things of that nature. But also buy Native clothing, Native outfits. There's a lot of things online. There's a lot of things in stores. There's, I think the Creek Nation does a big Christmas bazaar every year, and a lot of local artisans who you may want to buy jewelry from or things of that nature. There's galleries in Tulsa area you can buy Indian art from. And many of the artists have their own websites, so you can order prints online. There's so many different ways that you could invest your dollars. Not everything is going to get spent in Amazon, and they're going to make their money. Don't worry, they're not going to go broke. But if you could share a little bit of that money that you have for Christmas shopping, buy from a Native American artist or artisan. It would keep those people employed, keep them pursuing their art. Sometimes the amount of money they make during Christmas time is probably the biggest amount of money that they'll make all year. And you want to keep these people out there doing what they do. And so that's all. Make it a Native American Christmas this year.
Well, it would be wonderful. So thank you so much. I look forward to having you on again and reading your op-eds in the future. And for everyone listening, I will see you next time. Thank you.
Thank you.